The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a truly remarkable book. The introduction starts like this. Space, it says, is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the street to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen. And so on. After a while, the style settles down a bit, and it starts telling you things you actually need to know, like the fact that the fabulously beautiful planet Bethsilemen is now so worried about the cumulative erosion caused by 10 million visiting tourists a year that any net imbalance between the amount you eat and the amount you excrete whilst on the planet is surgically removed from your body weight when you leave. So every time you go to the lavatory there, it's vitally important to get a receipt.
That was an excerpt of the BBC radio series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Douglas Adams created the series in 1978. It traced the intergalactic adventures of Ford Prefect, who was researching the ultimate travel guide, and his reluctant Earthborn companion Arthur Dent. The series was a huge success and spawned its own mini-industry. Adams followed the radio drama with four Hitchhiker novels, which became bestsellers in England and the United States, where Hitchhiker was broadcast by NPR. There are also records, plays, a television version, and an interactive computer game. Adams' latest two books are set on Earth, featuring Dirk Gently, Holistic Detective. The new book, The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul, opens at Heathrow Airport.
It can hardly be a coincidence that no language on Earth has ever produced the expression as pretty as an airport. Airports are ugly. Some are very ugly. Some attain a degree of ugliness that can only be the result of a special effort. This ugliness arises because airports are full of people who are tired, cross, and have just discovered that their luggage has landed in Murmansk. A Murmansk airport is the only known exception to this otherwise infallible rule. And architects have on the whole tried to reflect this in their designs. They have sought to highlight the tiredness and crossness motif with brutal shapes and nerve-jangling colours to make effortless the business of separating the traveller forever from his or her luggage or loved ones, to confuse the traveller with arrows that appear to point at the windows, distant Tyrax or the current position of Ursa Minor in the night sky, and wherever possible to expose the plumbing on the grounds that it is functional and conceal the location of the departure gates, presumably on the grounds that they are not. Caught in the middle of a sea of hazy light and a sea of hazy noise, Kate Schechter stood and doubted.
Well, she is on her way to Norway, but at the airport while she's there, the terminal blows up. And first the PLO and the RA take credit for it, but the official conclusion is what?
The official conclusion is that it's an act of God in the end, and the question is which God and why, and what God would be hanging around the Terminal 2 of Heathrow trying to catch the 3:37 to Oslo.
Now, you actually introduce a couple of gods in this. I couldn't help but wonder what you were reading when you decided to introduce Thor, the Norse god of thunder, into your book.
Well, it was just trying to think about how gods would actually live and exist in today's world and what it would be like for them, because not only, I felt, would they be sort of completely hamstrung by it and unable to cope with it. But, I mean, the world has changed so much that they would just have no place in it, and I just felt would probably become destitute, which is what has happened to them.
Well, I'm going to leave the plot complications regarding the gods to your detective, Dirk Gently, to solve, but I'm going to ask you about something very mundane in your novel, and that is that the American character in it is obsessed, while she's in London, with finding a pizza place that delivers. I guess
yeah.
The London pizza places don't deliver. Is this your view of Americans, that we all want pizza delivered? And yeah,
I remember, because I lived in Los Angeles a few years ago, and we always used to have pizzas delivered to us, and it was infuriating that in England you just can't do it. In fact, since the book, I mean, literally in the last 6 months since I finished the book, one or two pizza places have started to deliver. I don't know if this is because in shame after what I said.
This is an example of a novel having profound repercussions.
Well, actually, oddly enough, there was one thing I was going to put in the book and then didn't. Because it's set in the same area that I live, and I've always wanted there to be a sushi bar near where I live. So I was going to have an incredibly successful sushi bar opening up in the book, sort of opening up just around the corner from me, and hope that somebody would take the hint.
Well, one thing you do have in your new novel is a computerized I Ching, which
That's
is
right,
an
yes.
interesting idea.
Well, it's funny how, I mean, every time you think you've thought of something far too absurd, you find, I mean, the next day that somebody else has actually done it. And you can now get, somebody's done a program for the Macintosh computer, which is the one I use, where you can consult the I Ching electronically. There was another thing in the book that I gave to Dirk a habit of my own, which is a certain means of navigation. I'm very bad at navigating, and I always get lost when I'm driving around London. And I use a system of sort of Zen navigation, which is if I don't know where I'm going, then I find a car that looks as if it knows where it's going, and I follow it. And it's always very effective. I mean, the effect may not be the effect I was after, but there's usually an effect. And then just a couple of months ago, I was staying in near Big Sur in Northern California, and came across a bookstore where they had a copy of a book called Zen Driving, How to Be a Buddha Behind the Wheel. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't suppose you can get this book outside Northern California, I don't know.
Actually, but, I've seen the book.
Have you?
Yeah, so I want to attest to the fact that you're not making this up. Your novels are filled with the big metaphysical questions. Did you ever study philosophy?
No, no. No, I studied English literature when I was at university. But always worried that I should have studied either history or medicine or very often I wish I'd done natural sciences, i.e. physics and maths.
I feel like you're a psychiatrist here, but were you a brooder? Did you used to lay around in college wondering about the meaning of life?
I don't know about I suppose I don't know that I wandered around thinking about the meaning of life, but I was always a bit of a brooder and a worrier. I think as a kid I was I was once seen actually to walk in broad daylight, slap bang into a lamppost. My mother used to worry about me. She hoped there was something going on the inside, because it sure as hell didn't seem to be anything going on the outside.
Now, you went to Cambridge. This yes. was late 60s, early 70s, right?
No, 71 to 74 I was at Cambridge.
Did you work for the College Humor magazine, anything like that?
It's funny, recently, my mother got in touch with me and said, look, I've just come across in the attic an old box full of your stuff from school, and I think it's time you looked after this. And I thought, well, I'll look through this and see what I was writing in those days. And, of course, there was hardly anything by me whatsoever, largely because, and this is a habit that I've carried on into my sort of professional life, I was always incredibly late with deadlines. And so I would always miss publication.
Okay. How did you start working at the BBC, which is where Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was first produced?
Well, I suppose I'd always thought I was going to be primarily a scriptwriter, but no, and basically I was having a lot of no success because I wasn't very good at writing sketches to order. The one sketch I remember of mine on the radio that actually, as much as anything else, had to do with my then being successful in getting Hitchhiker on. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say it, but it was a sketch about a kamikaze pilot being briefed for his 19th mission, and the commanding officer is trying very patiently to explain to him exactly what it was he was doing wrong.
So how did you come up with the idea for Hitchhikers?
There's lying drunk in a field in Innsbruck, you know, the way one does. This was 1971. Before I even went up to university, I was hitchhiking around Europe, and I had a copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to Europe. And as I say, I was lying drunk in this field, the stars came out, and it occurred to me at the time that somebody ought to write A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy as well. The odd thing about that story is that I've now told it so many times, because everybody asks me in every single interview, you know, how did you get the idea for Hitchhiker? Right. And so I tell the story again. But I now, because I've told the story so often, I now have no memory at all of the actual event.
Oh, I think I know what you mean, and you probably wonder if you've made it up.
Yes, well, all I can say is I've only got my own word for it.
Wasn't there supposed to be a film version?
Don't make me cry. Yes, there was meant to be a film version. I doubt if it'll ever happen.
What happened?
Hollywood.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've heard this story before.
I think
before.
That says as much as right. You need to know.
Douglas Adams, thanks a lot for talking with us.
All right, thanks, Terry.